The presenting sponsor of Food Safety Matters is Michigan State University. Food safety is a priority, and food safety professionals like you need the most up-to-date information on topics such as food security, food packaging, and emerging foodborne pathogens. Michigan State University offers a Master's of Science in Food Safety. It's 100% online, which will help you develop critical thinking, organizational and leadership skills, putting your companies at the forefront of the food safety initiative. Visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the Master's Program link to learn more. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacy Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here again with my co-host, Barbara Van Renterham, editorial director of the magazine. Always good to be here, Barbara. Always good. So in today's episode, you're going to hear Barbara's discussion with Will Daniels, president of the produce division at IEH Laboratories and Consulting Group. Over the years, Will's voice has become an incredibly important one in the industry. He's taken a leading role because of his willingness to freely share the lessons that he learned during the Earthbound Farms 2006 E. coli outbreak. Now, their discussion today isn't about that outbreak, but you can't listen to Will without hearing how that experience has influenced his approach to food safety. And I really, really encourage everybody to stay tuned for that. You'll be glad that you did. And just like that, Barbara, we're at the news.
We're at the news.
We're at the news. We're not fussing around today.
What's
we're not
in
messing
the news?
Around. Well, Frank Giannis, often referred to, I know. Just Frank. On January 27th, Frank Giannis, FDA's Deputy Commissioner for Food Policy and Response, announced that cattle feces from a nearby lot matched the strain of outbreaks in the fall of 2020 linked to leafy greens. The outbreak was declared over on December 22nd of 2020. So this announcement notes the end of the investigation and indicates that new findings confirm the presence of a recurring strain of E. coli 0157H7 in a region within the Salinas Valley that could serve as a potential source to be associated with future contamination events. While the connection was announced, there was no report of who owns or operates the animal or produce operations.
Well, you know, it's good that FDA has come out and made this connection. Clearly, we saw this before in Yuma with the suggestion that it was a nearby feedlot that was responsible for, again, the contamination of romaine. But my question for FDA, and maybe Frank could weigh in if he's listening, how do we mitigate this risk? And who was responsible for mitigating the risk? Does it matter who was there first, the feedlot or the grower of produce? I really see a battle escalating unless we can find some middle ground and try and address this, because it's not the first time, it won't be the last time, that there seems to be a battle between the cattle feeding operation and the grower. So we really need to get to the bottom of, now we have this connection, what do we do about it?
Well, I guess this is the first time that connection, otherwise, I guess you say in Yuma, but that was canal water, right? That they made the connection through the water. This doesn't really say that it was through the water.
But from the,
but I from
mean,
the CAFO.
I talked to people at USDA who essentially told me it was the cattle contaminating the canal water. So it's, again,
yeah. It seems that has long been known. I remember, well, speaking of Will Daniels, he was on an episode that we recorded at IAFP Live when a lot of this was first going on, and he said CAFOs, right? So people know. It's just right to your point, how are we going to mitigate that? Which also then leads in Frank's statement. He does say that, people are really looking at the goals in the Leafy and Greens Action Plan to take a look at that, and hopefully people can start to work towards a solution. We're still awaiting that final report on the investigation, and we will certainly post that as news, and I'm sure in future show notes when that becomes available. Okay, so our next story. FDA and USDA FSIS have long recommended rotating sanitizers in fresh-cut produce processing facilities to minimize the chance of pathogens developing tolerance. But now researchers at the University of Georgia are studying the risk of Listeria monocytogenes developing a tolerance to sanitizers with a specific focus on fresh produce operations. The project is titled Possibility, Duration, and Molecular Predictors of Sanitizer Tolerance in Listeria monocytogenes, which examines the potential for resistance to chlorine and quaternary ammonium compounds. The research will evaluate how different sanitizer levels and lengths of exposure affect the degree of tolerance in selected Listeria strains.
It's really interesting, Stacy. This is not a new concept.
No.
This is essentially antimicrobial resistance, whether it's a drug or, in the case here, chemicals. The recommendations are certainly appropriate, and I'm glad there's, you know, some scientists, you know, putting the exclamation point on this, but it's really common sense that you need to rotate what you're cleaning with. The concept has been around forever.
Well, that begs the question sort of then why the research? I mean, if everybody kind of knows this, but it says here that they're looking at two ways that Listeria, so maybe to better understand how that tolerance happens, right?
Right.
So I'm going to make this attempt. Xiangyun Dang is the leader, the lead researcher at the University of Georgia, who's looking at the two ways that Listeria can acquire tolerance. First, acquired resistance, which occurs when an organism is exposed to sublethal doses of a control agent. Those that survive commonly display but don't genetically acquire. Oh, where's the rest of my page here? Uh-oh. Those that survive commonly display but don't genetically acquire elevated tolerance to the agent. The second is evolved tolerance, which occurs by long-term exposure to sanitizers, establishing evolutionary changes to Listeria genomes.
Well, I think that's really interesting from a food science point of view. The first way that Listeria acquires tolerance is the reason why when you have a bacterial infection, your doctor tells you to take the entire dose mm-hmm. of the antibiotic because you don't want any of them surviving.
Because all you've done is just wounded them.
Right. So that's one way. Now, the long-term exposure, I don't know how you get around that except by rotating and mixing it up so that you can mm-hmm. skip some generations. So
yeah,
I think the research is important. I think this is an open door now to companies that produce sanitizers to maybe think outside the box and try and develop some new chemicals or new tools for the industry to use.
Well, when we posted this online, I certainly saw some engagement with the story and also from people who are selling sanitizers saying, and we've got recommendations on how to rotate stuff. So, you know, it is a long established protocol, but really understanding, and then how long does it take for them to develop for susceptibility to return. So it is, as you say, important research. And in another note, one of the funders for this research is the Center for Produce Safety. We also did an earlier story on our website about how they are seeking, they're in the middle of a funding campaign to raise $15 million to fund their research. We will put a link in our show notes if anybody wants to contribute to that. A lot of big companies have already participated at quite large levels, so anyway, we'll put that out there for you. And last but not least, researchers from San Diego State University, Virginia Tech, Loyola Marymount University, and Radford University are using text mining to try to pinpoint unique words and phrases in posts online to identify consumers' experiences with hazardous food products. The scientists say that they hope this will provide a practical and inexpensive means for rapidly monitoring food safety in real time. They compiled a large data set of labeled consumer posts spanning two major websites and were able to utilize a data set of, wait for it, over 4 million online reviews. According to the study's abstract, the researchers say that the results were 77 to 90% accurate in top-ranking reviews, while sentiment analysis, which is what I, in some of my research, I figured out was what they'd done previous to this, was 11 to 20% accurate. The researchers suggest that the use of these tools to, quote, profile food items and assess risk, building a post-market decision support system to identify hazardous food products.
I know that some public health agencies are also combing through data related to restaurants to kind of track and do surveillance. So,
well, and it seems like this sentiment analysis, when I poked around, that was focused around Yelp primarily, and that this seems to be going beyond that. So when we first read the story, we were kind of like, haven't we heard of this before? So I think that research has been going on like this for quite a few years, which says to me, this is where they're going. One way or another, we're going to get one way or another, we're going to be mining this data. We just have to figure out how, right?
And I know that Amazon looks at reviews on their site to try and get a leg up in case there's any third-party seller or even their own internal sales related to recalls or outbreaks. So,
yeah. So I guess watch this space, right?
It's a hot topic.
There you go. All right. We will, of course, post those links. As a matter of fact, we're going to post all the links to the resources that we've mentioned, and those will be in our show notes. Or you can find them on our podcast page at food-safety.com. You'll look for episode 89. And of course, don't forget to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Just search for Food Safety Magazine. And, you know, wait, before I get too far down the road, as long as I'm directing you to our website and all, I wanted to be sure to remind everybody about our amazing webinar series that is going to be starting on February 25th. There's still time to register to attend the live broadcast of our first in a series of 5 webinars with Lone Jesperson, a globally recognized leader on food safety culture. In the series, Lone will explore how the unique regional cultures of where your company is located impact your company's food safety culture. And our first stop is Europe. So this episode will feature Lone, a European representative from 3M Food Safety, who is this 3M Food Safety is the sponsor of the webinar series, and food safety experts from Danone. We will follow up this webinar with explorations of Australia, Asia, North America, and Latin America in future webinars. So register at food-safety.com. Find webinars under our events tab, and don't miss it. It'll be great. Okay, so now it's time for Barbara's discussion with Will Daniels, president of the Produce Division at IEH Laboratories and Consulting Group. Prior to joining IEH, Will was president and CEO of Fresh Integrity Group, a consulting firm specializing in operations and food safety consulting for the fresh produce and perishable industries. From 1999 until 2014, Will was with Earthbound Farm. Having leadership roles in both quality assurance and operations, he helped the company grow from a small regional salad producer to the nation's largest grower, packer, and shipper of organic produce. As Earthbound Farm's chief food integrity officer, Will was responsible for food safety, food quality, and the company's organic integrity program. Will is a sought-after speaker and has addressed key issues in food safety at many industry meetings, including the Food Safety Summit. And most importantly, soon it's going to be, soon it's going to be, our listeners are going to be saying this all on their own. Okay, so all together now. And most importantly, Will is a member of Food Safety Magazine's Editorial Advisory Board.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So you mentioned that he's a sought-after speaker. So he gave the keynote at the Food Safety Summit last year. And after I heard him, I said, I need to have him back on the podcast. So that was the inspiration behind having him back on. But as you mentioned, he covers a whole lot of really great topics. So it's one not to be missed.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah, Will's great. All right. So after a quick break, we'll hear that interview. Michigan State University, the nation's premier land-grant institution, is leading the way in food-related education and research. But what some don't know is just how accessible a graduate degree in food safety is from this leading Big Ten institution. Michigan State University offers an MS in food safety that's only 30 credit hours and taught completely online, designed for you, the working professional. Courses are designed to be flexible, applicable, and students can tailor their electives to include coursework in food law, packaging, or public health. This degree program will help increase your depth of knowledge in food safety and help prepare your company for any food safety challenges. Visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the master's program link to learn more.
Well, hi, Will. Welcome back to the podcast.
Barb, it's great to hear you and see you virtually.
Yeah, it wasn't too long ago. Not too long ago at the summit, we were able to see each other virtually. And speaking of the Food Safety Summit, you gave a very provocative talk, which you always do, which is one of the reasons you're so great as a speaker. But I wanted to follow up with you in more detail about how, as an industry, we can become more focused on the human side of public health when it comes to food safety. So let's get started. And we can't get more human than you talking about what you went through at Earthbound Farm in 2006. You mentioned during your talk that this is, you know, you're only recently able to talk about your experiences there. And I can only imagine all the feelings and emotions around that event for you. So while no food safety professional or company ever wants to make someone sick, how do you wrap your head around the fact that food is not a zero risk commodity? If it was truly zero risk, we'd have to test all of it, right? So how do you come to terms with that after your experience, you know, with illness at Earthbound?
Well, it is a certainly a huge challenge for us in the industry. There is always going to be risk associated with foods and consumption of food. But what I tried to point out in my talk was that we just perhaps aren't setting our tolerance for risk at the right level. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we've kind of disassociated ourselves with the consumer over time. And that is, I think, one of the biggest challenges for industry today is how can we reconnect with the consumer in ways that we haven't for the past couple of decades. My experience with Earthbound, to me, the part that really was difficult for me to speak about was the human element, the fact that we actually injured over 200 folks and 3 to 5 people died as a result. And in my talk, I spoke about one of those young victims, Kyle Allgood, who his mom gave him a smoothie with some of our spinach in it, and as a result, he passed away. And that to me is the real difficult part to talk about. But you know, in the end, it is where we need to be and what we need to be focused on. It's those consumers because You know, as I said, you don't want to wish that upon your worst enemy. And it's not something I could ever imagine happening to my own family.
Right. I think what's so powerful about stories like yours and about Jack in the Box, going back to 1993, is that those stories really connect the dots for people working in the food industry, that they need to always keep in mind that if they're not paying attention to the food safety tasks that they're being asked to do, something like that could happen. And if they can put a name and a face to that, I think that that's really a powerful motivation for them to stay on task. You had talked about the importance of a food company's social responsibility in terms of prioritizing consumers' health by producing and selling safe food, really putting the individual in the center. What are your recommendations for how food safety professionals can drive a change like this at their respective companies?
Well, it is a huge challenge because not only do you have to first convince your food safety team and your senior leadership that that's where the focus needs to be, but then, as you mentioned, you need to drive that down to the workforce on the floor. And your program is only as strong as your weakest link. And, you know, that could be an employee on the floor who either doesn't care or doesn't understand what it is that they're trying to do out there. So bringing that focus that, you know, they're not making widgets, they're making something that people consume, and quite often it'll be their own family that are consuming these foods. That's the most important thing. So you know, one of the things that I mentioned in the talk was really, you know, first of all, educating folks that even though there is very a small chance of something happen, that small chance can happen to somebody you know, and that would be devastating to anybody. And so we don't want that to happen. So how do we continue to personalize it? And you know, one of the things I spoke about was education and making sure that, you know, you put the face to it. You tell the stories about consumers who have gotten ill and are facing, you know, a lifetime of health challenges, or families who have lost loved ones due to foodborne illness. You know, this is for the most part preventable. We can do more as industries in food to protect the consumer. And, you know, like I said, it's really that readjustment on the risk side to ensure that you're doing everything you can to make the safest product possible.
Now, what approaches do you have for dealing with senior management? It always comes down to cost. At a company, because the margins are so slim. I'm just curious for our listeners who might have opportunities to interface directly with the senior management at their companies. How do they tell those stories in a way that really connects with kind of the money-driven mindset of most corporate leaders?
Well, certainly one of the great tools out there is inviting organizations like STOP to come in and give a presentation, you know, with consumers who have been infected by foodborne illness. Really driving that story home, I think, is the first place to start. But you're right. At the end of the day, the senior management is most concerned about dollars. And so, you know, adding cost to a program to bring a little bit more assurance that that you're making safe food might be an uphill climb and a difficult discussion to have. So, you know, one of the things I'm an advocate for is making sure that as a QA professional, as a food safety professional, you have the financial side of the business in mind, and when you are making recommendations or suggestions around, you know, those things that are going to enhance your program, that you can counter it with a savings opportunity, because, you know, we can't drive our programs, you know, into the negative side of things and expect us to survive as a company. So we've got to be profitable. But as I explained, you know, it isn't an achievable task if you can get everybody on the same page and everybody's pushing in the same direction. When we were at Earthbound, we led with our food safety program, but we were also owned by private equity, so we were really driving towards value to the bottom line, and so we had to maintain that industry leading program and also enhance our bottom line, and we were able to achieve both. So I do believe that it's possible if everybody understands that not only food safety but profitability is valuable and an important objective.
So why does it seem that the companies who have gone through a crisis event are the ones that are really excited about making the changes and on board with the changes, but companies that haven't gone through a major crisis are kind of slow to come around? They're going to do the minimal they have to comply with regulations. They're not going to go above and beyond. I've talked to a lot of people on the podcast. You know, we started with Dave Thino. We've talked to Randy at Maple Leaf, yourself. It's easier to make those decisions when the company's been really hit because of a crisis. But do you have any ideas for how to sway a company leader in the absence of a huge crisis event?
Well, that is a huge challenge, I think, because this phenomenon happens again and again, and it has since Jack in the Box and probably before Jack in the Box. Unfortunately, it really takes a crisis for companies to pay attention and realize that you know, that they could be affected by these kind of events. And really, I think what it boils down to is that people are so confident with their company and their programs that they don't think it's going to happen to them. And the reality is that these organisms are blind and don't you know, target people with good or bad programs. And all it takes is for you know, one event to happen, and it, you know, ripples through the organization in a way that could devastate a company. So you know, I wish that companies would pay attention to the folks that are talking about things like this. I mean, geez, I've been talking about our outbreak since 2006, and you know, I still believe that folks think that we, you know, did something wrong, and that's why, you know, we had the outbreak. I think it's just telling these stories over and over again until folks understand that, you know, they shouldn't want to be a part of this, you know, side of the industry, wrapped up in a crisis, you know, involving foodborne illness. And so I think that it really, we're going to have to keep talking about it and keep driving the stories, and education, I think, is the biggest thing at the top, is really helping the senior leadership, understand what it is, what the risks are, how it could affect the business, and what the you know, the impact to business could be as a result, and not just business, but again, the people who are consuming the product. And you know, again, if you can drive that back to the senior leadership, the CEO, the president of the company, hey, your family's sitting around the table eating our products, you know, we don't want to make you and your family sick, so you know, help us. And gosh, Barb, I wish I could wave a wand and get folks to act before a crisis, but I don't think we're going to be able to.
Right. You know, you brought up a really important point, and that is that the companies that I mentioned, you know, yourself and Maple Leaf, were you know, complying with all of the regulations that were out there and going above and beyond the regulations.
I took a lot of pride in our business and our food safety program or organic integrity program or any program that was audited. I ensured that we would never have the same observation twice in an audit. You know, that was my goal, is to continuously improve year over year. And you know, I felt that in 2006, we had a real strong program. I know we were operating at which were industry best standards at the time. You know, we were so excited. We had the FDA in with auditor training program. We had about 45 new FDA auditors in through the facility. And, you know, I don't want to say I felt invincible, but, you know, I felt that since we were operating at that industry best level, that we were somewhat protected, and that wasn't the case.
It's an important lesson that I think more people need to learn. So, Will, we can't have you on the podcast without talking more about produce, specifically leafy greens. So I'm going to set the stage for you, because my head's been spinning around the past couple of weeks about the latest E. coli outbreaks. There have been three now, as of this recording, of E. coli 0157H7. This latest one, this third one, appears to be more directly tied to romaine. But, so here's the issue I want to throw at you. So the first two outbreaks, looking at the press releases from FDA and CDC, I'm seeing some mixed messages, and I want to get your opinion about this. So the first outbreak that just recently happened, neither agency named a source, but FDA mentioned that the outbreak strain was similar to strains causing outbreaks in the past. CDC linked it as the same strain that caused an outbreak linked to romaine in 2018. For the second, FDA, again, similar to an outbreak strain we've seen before, but CDC is linking that one as identical to the strain from that caused the outbreak in romaine in 2019. And then we have this third one. So I'm a little confused about the differences in these releases with the same in principle investigations. Am I being too picky about the semantics, or are our agencies sending the wrong message, or what do you think's going on?
Well, I think that it is a challenge, and I think that we are just learning how to best communicate whole genome sequencing and how those results relate to incidents in the past and what to do about them. And I think that it's going to get a little bit more complicated before it gets better, or we kind of have some run rules with how we deal with things like this. Because, you know, in fact, the most recent clinical cases are lining up with outbreak trees from whole genome sequences in the past. And that's where it's coming from. And perhaps the difference is how they define matches or proximity by the number of SNPs associated with it. And I am not a whole genome sequence professional, you know, to speak any further beyond it than that. But it does come down to SNPs and proximity to those SNPs. And I think that some would say, yes, it's close. And some would say, oh, no, it's a couple of SNPs off and too far away. So that might be where some of it's coming from. You know, and I also think that there's some politics at play here. You know, unfortunately, we've seen some backlash from both industry and the FDA with respect to outbreaks and calling things too early or not soon enough or not naming the people or the companies involved. And so I think that the FDA is trying to wade into some new territory with caution and make sure that they don't over or understate things, which is probably leading to the confusion.
So what do we keep getting wrong with romaine? Let's say, just for argument, now we're not saying this, all our listeners, that these were actually tied to romaine, but let's assume that all three are can be tied to romaine. What do we keep getting wrong with romaine lettuce? We've had this cyclical, you know, outbreaks for the past 2 or 3 years. Can you walk me through what the main challenges are with leafy greens and what you think the next step should be?
Well, certainly, you know, the main challenges with leafy greens is the proximity to the ground in which it grows and the short cycle in the field, anywhere from 20 to, you know, for baby leaf, it could be 20-day crop all the way up to, you know, a 90-day crop. And there's a lot of variability within those systems. It's not a uniform system. So we've got lots of different ways to grow and cultivate. One of the specific challenges that we know with romaine is its physiological characteristics, the way in which it grows. The leaves form on the outside of the plant and form a cup coming together. And so essentially, those early leaves become the heart of the plant and create some challenges with respect to, you know, how things can harbor in that plant as it grows, versus a head of iceberg, which, you know, very simplistically grows from the inside out and is essentially, you know, the center of that plant never sees the light of day until you break it open. So there is some challenges with iceberg with romaine specifically with respect to its physiological characteristics. I also just think that the sheer number of pounds that are produced and consumed certainly create a little bit of a challenge, just because it's, you know, the leading commodity on the lettuce side, and what everybody associates themselves eating lettuce. When they eat a salad, it's got to be romaine. It's got to have romaine in it, typically. So, I think that also drives some of the numbers and some of the concerns.
Now, I know that you did reference the produce rule in your talk, and the fact that the irrigation water standards aren't due to be, formalized for another few years. Is that an impediment to getting past some of these issues with growing lettuces in general?
You know, I think that one of the things that as an industry we've been trying to solve for the last, 14, 15 years is finding that silver bullet or the one reason why and how we have contamination. And certainly what I've learned over the years is that the vectors for contamination are many, and that we don't just have one single control to prevent contamination of leafy greens. So it's that in and of itself creates a lot of challenges.
Do you think the fact that the irrigation water standards for the produce rule aren't due to be formalized for another couple of years, is that an impediment to kind of moving forward with, you know, the safe growing of lettuce?
No, I really don't think so. I mean, you know, as I said in my talk, you know, regulation is going to be the minimum standard, and industry is already moving beyond whatever it is that the FDA will likely come up with in the produce rule. Most of the leafy greens producers today are treating the water before they irrigate in the last, couple of weeks of their irrigation cycle. So the LGMA has addressed the water issue to what they believe is the appropriate level. And, you know, back to my earlier comment, the fact that, you know, we're creating a water metric or changing the metrics because we've identified contaminated water in a canal, it's a it's one of several additional changes that probably need to be made to the metrics out there to further enhance our food safety programs.
Now, you had also you just mentioned that, you know, many companies are going beyond the regulations. So FDA can take another couple of years. The industry is going to make those changes first. You had mentioned in your talk that one of the reasons why companies are going beyond the regulations is because retailers are pushing them to do so. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, in my talk, I spoke about the fact, you know, and as I mentioned, you know, regulation is really the minimum requirements and standards, and it has a lot to do with the fact that the regulation doesn't want to create an uneven playing field for the market, so they can't make things too burdensome on the food safety side, for example. So, as a result, we end up with regulation that's probably, you know, missing some elements that could enhance the food safety of whatever it is that they're trying to protect. And then beyond that, you have industries that are trying to, you know, raise their game, if you will, and get confidence back up. And the leafy greens is a good example of that. In 2007, they created the Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement, which is an industry-led initiative to ensure the safety of the product, and brought metrics to the field that there were never there before, and a system of that you could audit that program, and that enhanced the food safety dramatically in produce. But there's still yet another segment that felt that there was still more that could be done, and that's the folks with those consumer-facing brands, and they are the ones that push for things like pathogen testing in produce that go above and beyond regulation or those agreements, the marketing agreements, and so, you know, I think that really they see the value in protecting their consumer as much as they possibly can. I certainly feel protected when I shop at a Costco, for example, because I know that the programs that are behind, the brands that they sell through their stores. And so I think that really, is one of the reasons why they're asking for more, is because they see their consumers every day. They are nothing without their consumers. Whereas, you know, a salad company is selling to another major brand that's then going to sell their product. And so they're removed from that exposure to the consumer, like those forward-facing brands are.
So it sounds like the rest of the industry could take a lesson from the retailers in putting the consumer back in the center, and making some of those changes for the consumer's benefit.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really interesting that industry tends to, we're kind of a little backwards in the fact that, you know, it's our customers that are the ones that are driving strong food safety programs, when in fact, my argument should be it should be coming from industry, because ultimately we're the ones that are making the food that people are consuming and either getting sick on or having a healthy experience. And so it's up to us to make sure it's as safe as possible. And I find it odd that we need consumer brands to push us in the right direction.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned about a widening gap between companies that are going above and beyond the regulations and those who are having difficulty even understanding current good manufacturing practices, for example. Can you talk a little bit about the potential consequences of this widening gap between companies?
Well, I think that we're unfortunately going to be exposing a lot more of these products that are driving foodborne illness because we'll be able to identify clusters of foodborne illness in smaller numbers as we've seen over the last couple of years with whole genome sequencing. And so we're going to be exposing those brands that are not doing enough to protect the consumer. I think more and more we'll see that happening. It's a real travesty, in my opinion, because the folks that are struggling with basic current good manufacturing practices, to ask them to put in a preventative controls plan and a foreign supplier verification program and all of the elements of FSMA is really a heavy lift. And there's, unfortunately, our land grant universities, the funding for support to industry is drying up. And so it's becoming more and more of a challenge for those smaller companies to find somebody to reach out to help them. At least that's been my experience over the last few years.
I'd kind of like to pivot a little bit now to another topic that you had discussed. I'd like to poke you a little bit on, and that is the challenges of keeping food workers safe during the pandemic. So early on in the pandemic, when there was a shortage of PPE and the science was changing all the time and there was no clear guidance at a federal level, there was a lot in the mass media about what food plants were doing, particularly the meat industry. That seems to have improved, except that the headline in USA Today on the front page was about a pork plant and talking about the number of cases that escalated over a short period of time and the number of deaths that they've had. Do you think that the food industry to a point was unfairly targeted early in the pandemic by the media, or did they do the best they could? You have an opinion about that?
Well, I think that we were an easy target because there was something to talk about. The industry, wasn't built with 6 feet distance between workstations in mind ever, right? We always needed to be as efficient as possible, and space is a value, and so as a result, all of these factories are meant to have people right next to each other, and so that in and of itself had created huge challenges. Beyond that, the labor forces that support these food manufacturing facilities are often very communal and very socially connected, whether it be a certain ethnicity of employee that may be working there, or families, generations of families working. And so, the close proximity work coupled with the social aspects of the labor force created somewhat of an easy target, right? We saw upticks in numbers right away as we were learning how to best protect the employees and communities. I think that the industry reacted really well. The media will sensationalize things, and certainly there was some gruesome stories out there, and unfortunately there will always be some folks that aren't being well taken care of. But I think as a whole, I think we reacted very well. We saw, at least in produce, we saw a very swift reaction to protecting the workforce and making sure they were safe, and educating them. All the elements that we need for strong food safety, it was happening on the employee safety side. And so I really think that there's a huge opportunity to leverage that and make the most of it with respect to your food safety program.
Sure. And just as you had mentioned, in the case of romaine and a lot of different factors at play, I think in the meat industry, you can't control what your employees are doing once they leave the plant. So you could have the best program in place to protect them at work, but what they do after work certainly would impact how they were exposing fellow workers in the plant. You know, OSHA has gotten a lot of play, obviously, for employee health and safety. And you had briefly touched on the fact that they had the responsibility, if they saw and felt that employees were at risk, that they could close a plant or assess some fines. But what do you make of the really ridiculously low fines that have been levied so far? I mean, I personally don't think that that is a driver of change, because that's really a drop in the bucket for these plants. But have any thoughts about that?
I think you're right. I don't think it's going to affect change whatsoever. I feel like perhaps they felt like they were, you know, they didn't want to be piling on to the issues. But you know, in the end, they're there for a reason. They have the ability to fine companies for a reason. And if that tool is appropriate and it motivates companies to do the right thing, you know, outside of the company that's being fined, I think it's the appropriate tool to use. So to answer your question, you know, by levying small fines, I don't think it's bringing any value.
Right. You know, Will, as we wrap up today, I want to circle back to the consumer. And you had noted earlier that consumers are really driving a lot of the changes in food safety, but they're also making some additional demands that I wonder if they're not overtaxing the industry. So, and some things that they want are very good. I'm not taking issue with that. They're demanding transparency about where the foods are coming from and the processes that companies are undertaking to produce the food. They want clean labels with ingredients that they can pronounce, healthier choices, as you talked about earlier, and sustainable practices. The list goes on and on. But do you think that when food producers and the food safety professionals working for them add these items to their already very full and important to-do list, that there's a possibility that some basic food safety steps are getting overlooked?
Well, it certainly adds a lot of complexity to it. Although, you know, most of these things have been initiatives for most food companies for quite some time. I think that it's just taken, you know, this many years for these changes to start to become real. You know, we've been talking about, you know, transparency and healthier choices and all of those challenges and consumer demands for years now. And you know, companies have been working towards it, but more, you know, kind of in the corporate level, not really, you know, forward facing to the consumer. And now is that time. How do we ensure that doesn't, you know, distract from food safety programs? I think that it's just a matter of ensuring that, you know, food safety is at the forefront of the company's objectives. You know, while all of these things are very valuable, you don't have a brand if you're making unsafe food. So, you know, these things, the transparency, the clean labels, the healthier choices are all things to follow after a strong food safety program, in my opinion.
So one kind of following up on that idea, when a consumer doesn't want preservatives because they're chemicals that they can't pronounce in their food, do you think that has to go hand in hand with educating that consumer about what the lack of a preservative means, that they, you know, that the shelf life is affected? So do you think the consumers really understand what it is they're asking for and the ramifications?
No,
of what they're asking.
No, I don't. I think we've got a long ways to go with respect to their education and understanding of what it is that they're asking for. And really, it kind of ties into the fact that, you know, industry has lost touch with the consumer. You know, I would say that the same with the consumer and industry, right? We have become used to seeing exotic fruits and vegetables in our markets, at least here in California, year-round, right? Whereas when I was growing up as a kid, there was seasonality to the produce department and what was in it. And that's completely changed. And so, you know, we're exposing we're exposing the consumer to so much more out there. And it's really, you know, creating opportunity, but so many more challenges as a result of that.
I was just going to add that I personally, despite the fact that I can get tomatoes year round, I only grow my own.
There you go.
Because they taste best right off the plant. So see, seasonality doesn't matter. If I really want the flavor, I have to wait until the summer here in Massachusetts, grow my own tomatoes.
It happens here in California too.
You grow your own tomatoes?
I do, yes. And you know, like you said, there's nothing better than a fresh tomato off the vine.
I can't let you go without asking what activities you miss most that you can't do because of the pandemic.
Wow. I think that I really miss having friends and family over to sit around the table and break bread. You know, talk about our lives over a delicious meal. I think that that is so elemental to society and our well-being that, you know, I really miss it and look forward to the day that we can get back to that.
Amen. I agree with you. Well, I want to thank you so much, Will, for joining me today. And for those who weren't able to be a part of the virtual Food Safety Summit, you got a little snapshot of Will's talk here and some of the items that he talked about. But thank you so much for coming back with us.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you again for having me.
Thanks again to Will Daniels for joining us on the podcast today. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. And a special thanks to our presenting sponsor, Michigan State University. Please visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the master's program link to learn more about their Master's of Science in Food Safety. You'll find links to all the references we mentioned in the episode in our show notes. You can access those in your podcast player or on our website at food-safety.com. Hit the podcast tab in the top navigation and then find episode 89. And please, don't ever, ever hesitate to send us your questions and suggestions to podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. And to make sure that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your feed, click that subscribe button. And while you're there, please take a moment and rate the podcast. You know, throw some stars our way. It's good for everybody. That's it for us today. Our next regular episode will post on February 23rd. Take good care of yourselves and those around you, and we'll talk to you then.